From KCUR News, this is Casey Currents reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith. On this week's show, preparing for Tuesday's elections, Missouri's Amendment 2, state primaries, and a sales tax question.
And you get improvements to both parks and streets, which are things that citizens say are top priorities for them and also things that they feel the city has not been properly maintaining to date.
Fire Chief Smokey Dyer retired earlier this week. Since he was 5 years old, he knew he wanted to be a fireman and even was a part of a volunteer unit. We'll look back at his career.
Leaving the fire service after the only thing you've really known, and a lot of times people say in their adult life, in my case, it's my entire life. It's very emotional for me.
And a young farmer's efforts to fix up a house that's been part of his family for five generations.
Listen up for Casey Currents just after this hour's news. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith. Casey Currents is KCUR's weekly magazine show. We use voices, stories, and sound to take you to neighborhoods around the region.
When Missouri voters go to the poll on Tuesday, they'll be asked to decide on an amendment to the state constitution. Supporters say the Missouri Right to Pray Amendment will protect residents' right to practice their religion. Those against it say it's not only redundant, but sneaky. St. Louis Public Radio's Julie Bierock reports.
Missouri House Speaker Pro Tem Shane Scholer, who is a vocal supporter of the amendment, says in recent months there have been a series of attacks on our religious freedom from liberals. He blames President Barack Obama for trying to force religious institutions to provide contraception, and he blames the ACLU for continually bringing lawsuits when someone's tried to practice their faith in public. He says it's time to fight back.
We are clarifying this because lawsuits continue to go forward, and we're trying to make sure people don't have to live in fear that if they would choose to practice their faith in public setting like that, that there somehow is not going to be some recourse against them.
Missourians already have religious freedom under not only the state constitution, but the U.S. Constitution. So opponents call the measure redundant, broad, and confusing.
It's really just an ocean of legalese. I mean, I'm a lawyer who's been practicing for almost a decade, and I have trouble understanding exactly what this thing really does.
Gregory Lipper is an attorney with Americans United for Separation of Church and State. He says the amendment covers every aspect of life, from schools to the town square to public meetings. And in trying to solve a problem that doesn't actually exist, the effect will be to transfer lots of taxpayer dollars to lawyers. Missouri bishops are encouraging Catholics to vote for the amendment. Tyler McClay is an attorney and lobbyist for the Missouri Catholic Council, the public policy agency for the Catholic Church in Missouri. He acknowledges that the amendment will not create a new constitutional right, and he agrees it's broad, but he says that's not unusual.
Constitutional provisions tend to be more broadly written, and so they'll need to be interpreted or there'll need to be some clarification made maybe down the road. But I don't think that's uncommon with this kind of thing.
Critics have another problem with the amendment. Seventh grade Ladue science teacher Elizabeth Peterson takes issue with the ballot summary, or in particular what the ballot summary leaves out. The measure reads, in short, that Missouri citizens have the right to express their religious beliefs, school children have the right to pray in their schools, and public schools will display the Bill of Rights of the U.S. Constitution. It makes no mention that the amendment would allow students to opt out of assignments or presentations that violate his or her religious beliefs.
Yeah, it's absolutely sneaky. And, you know, science is not about being sneaky. It's putting our cards on the table and saying, here's what it says.
So if the amendment passes, what constitutes a religious belief? Can a student decide they can't do their chemistry homework because covalent bonds go against their religion? And if they opt out of a biology assignment because they don't believe in evolution, can they still pass the course?
That's the big question. I don't know.
Representative Scholer says that would be up to local school officials.
I think most boards of education, you know, local school boards, are very conscientious that when a law like this passes, they're going to set up some guidelines for their local teachers to be able to follow.
Peterson fears that students are the ones who will suffer if opting out of critical science coursework is widely permitted.
I think it's important that kids understand if you opt out of this, here's what you're missing. I mean, and in biology, because evolution is such a major understanding, you don't take biology, maybe you don't graduate. So I keep thinking, why would the legislator intentionally handicap kids. I mean, it's bad legislation.
The ballot summary was challenged in a lawsuit earlier this year, but in June, a state appeals court ruled that the challenge was without merit. A recent St. Louis Post-Dispatch poll of 625 registered Missouri voters revealed that the amendment is likely to pass, with 82% saying they would have voted in favor of it if the primary was held last week. I'm Julie Bierock, St. Louis Public Radio.
Entering the final sprint of the primary season, a clear frontrunner between the three main GOP candidates for the U.S. Senate race in Missouri has yet to emerge. There's no major differences in their respective platforms, and St. Louis Public Radio's Tim Lloyd reports that the Republican primary is more about personality and background than policy.
Most of the people gathered outside of Washington University's Edison Theater before a recent GOP Senate primary debate already knew who they would vote for. But Shelby Huerdine wasn't sure yet, so she drove in from St. Charles to get a better feel for the character of each candidate.
I don't know how else people are going to look at it, because they are very similar on the issues, so we'll see.
And during the debate, the three main candidates laid out basically the same policy platform. Here's St. Louis businessman John Bruner on government expenditures.
Number one, we just have to stop the spending.
This is former state senator and treasurer Sarah Steelman on reining in the size of the federal government.
So I support a balanced budget amendment to the Constitution and a cap on the size of government.
And Congressman Todd Akin on the Affordable Care Act.
And I won't give up until every last sentence of Obamacare is repealed.
With little separation between their respective policy platforms, all three are racing to establish themselves as the most honest-to-goodness, sure-bet conservative.
I'd say it's a campaign for the heart and soul of a Republican Party that has some real fissures right now, some real splits.
Dave Robertson is a political scientist at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. He says when it comes to policy, you have to magnify the fine points to see any daylight between their positions.
We're going to see a little bit of a differentiation on health care, for example. Todd Akin is taking a very anti-government approach and would like people left to make more of their own decisions. Sarah Steelman, with an economics background, is arguing that there should be more competitiveness in markets. These aren't big differences, but they're different approaches to applying conservatism.
And as for Bruner, his solution for affordable health care starts with tort reform. Using almost entirely his own money, he's outspent each of his opponents about 10 to 1 so far. Bruner says it's justified because he's facing candidates who are already known to Missouri Republicans.
You have to spend the dollars to let folks know that there is another choice, and that's my only motivation.
He says that as a successful businessman, he's best suited to fix a struggling economy. And to fortify his pitch to voters, Bruner's campaign is pumping out TV ads that portray his competitors as career politicians. At the end of this one, a photo of Akin morphs into Barack Obama, and Sarah Steelman shape-shifts to Claire McCaskill.
Government mandates supporting trial lawyers. Sound familiar?
Akin calls the ad laughable and says he's the most conservative member of the state's congressional delegation. On a recent evening, he's standing in the parking lot of Iacovelli's restaurant next to I-270. Before speaking to the local Republican club, Akin says his strategy is to avoid going negative.
Bruner and Steelman, they're good people. Why should I run them down to push myself up? So our theory has been, okay, let's keep it positive.
Steelman, on the other hand, has no problem swinging back at Bruner. She bristles when asked to respond to Bruner's claim that she's playing into a Democratic effort to target him.
John Bruner has done nothing but attack since day one. He has run literally millions and millions of dollars against me and against Congressman Akin in vicious attacks. And so for him to say that is ridiculous.
Steelman has worked to position herself as the true outsider of the trio and more in touch with rural constituents. Steelman, Akin, and Bruner will spend the remaining days before the August 7th primary barnstorming the state, looking to win over any undecided Republicans. In St. Louis, I'm Tim Lloyd.
Other primary candidates are Jerry Beck, Mark Mamoli, Mark Lodes, Robert Poole, and Hector Maldonado.
And the election coverage continues with a look now at the Kansas primaries. Moderate Republicans have come under attack in primaries around the country this year, but the split within the GOP in Kansas is perhaps older and sharper than anywhere else.
Kansas Governor Sam Brownback, a Republican, has targeted a group of Republican state senators for removal. It's a savage fight fueled by money from the Koch brothers and labor unions, pitting Republican against Republican in one of the reddest of red states. KCUR's Frank Morris reports.
When it comes to the political map, Kansas isn't just red, it's a stoplight. It's molten lava. Republicans hold every congressional seat in all the big statewide offices and both chambers of the legislature. But despite their lock on power, Kansas Republicans do not get along.
We are our own worst enemy.
Tim Owens is a state senator, struggling to stay that way.
We've met the enemy, and the enemy is us.
Owens is waging one of the toughest campaigns in his 30-year political career. Yesterday, he was dispensing yard signs at a strip mall on Metcalf in his prosperous suburban Kansas City district.
What, five or six?
Yeah, they'll be fine.
Is that enough?
Yeah, they'll be
and
enough.
And examining some of the mailings his constituents have been getting, one of which looks and reads a lot like a greeting card.
Here's a couple of them there. Obama sought a robot and found one. And then they've got Obama and me, which is absolutely ridiculous.
Now, Owens is a lifelong Republican, so this is pretty scandalous stuff, and it's coming from his own party.
The conservative element today is a far cry from what the conservative was when I was growing up. It's not the same. It's angry, it's hateful, it's anti.
Bridges have been burned.
Jim Denning, a freshman state representative, is challenging Owens.
I think the lines have been drawn in the sand. Everybody is all in on this election.
Denning says that Owens and a handful of other moderates crossed the line when they teamed up with Democrats to block elements of Kansas Governor Sam Brownback's conservative fiscal and social agenda. Conservatives like Jeff Melcher were outraged.
There is a party for people who want big government and high taxation. That's the Democrat Party, and that's where a lot of the moderates belong.
Melcher, a businessman, is running for office for the first time this year to replace another moderate Republican in the state Senate. Chris Kobach, the Secretary of State in Kansas, says these races are drawing big bucks.
It's coming from all different sources within the state of Kansas and outside of the state of Kansas. You have organizations, interest groups, unions, individuals.
Moderate Republicans have made common cause with some of the state's biggest labor unions. Meantime, Koch Industries, the Wichita-based multinational conglomerate owned by the famous Koch brothers, has been fueling conservative campaigns. Burdette Loomis at the University of Kansas expects record spending. But the strangest thing, he says, is Governor Brownback working systematically to dismantle powerful incumbents within his own party.
Governors often have problems with people in their own party, whether it's Democrats or Republicans. That's not unusual. But to have this kind of absolutely brutal internecine warfare is certainly unprecedented.
But not completely unexpected. After all, monumental changes are at stake. The governor wants to nominate appellate court judges and have them approved in the Senate. Moderates in the Senate saw that as a move to take over the judiciary and stopped him. Conservatives outmaneuvered moderates and passed deep business tax cuts, which the state's legislative research department says will trigger a $2.5 billion shortfall 5 years from now. Moderates say that can only mean huge reductions in spending for education and social services. Their conservative opponents, like Melcher, say the cuts will rev up business so much that only minor cuts will be necessary. And they want to go farther, eliminating income tax altogether.
That's the nice thing about states. They're experiments. And we're going through an experiment now, and one that I think we're going to come on the other end. We're going to be a very successful state as a result of this.
Melcher says Kansas is failing to keep up, losing jobs, and falling behind other states. He blames 40 years of moderate rule.
The moderates have had their chance, and it was a failure.
When you say, gee, we're failing in Kansas, Johnson County doesn't think we're failing.
Pat Colleton is running against Melcher to represent the 11th Senate District.
The Johnson County businesses want to keep what we've got. We don't want to lose it to a completely different model, these grand ideological plans, speculative ideas of the Koch brothers.
One thing moderate and conservative Republicans in Kansas agree on, this election matters. Secretary Kobach is backing the conservative slate.
Tax policy will largely be driven by the outcome on August 7th. The school finance formula, abortion-related issues, judicial selection policy, issues like illegal immigration measures that the state may or may not pass.
And all that influence, Burdette Loomis says, rests with a very small number of voters.
Strangely enough, this Republican primary is one of the most important elections in Kansas history. And at the end of the day, the decisions will be made by 20 or 25% turnout among Republicans.
Not even that many, probably. Kobach predicts just 18% turnout Tuesday when registered Republicans choose the future of Kansas. Frank Morris, KCUR News.
And also on Tuesday, Kansas City, Missouri voters will get the chance to decide on two measures which would give the city more money for maintenance and upgrades. One's a request to issue bonds for sewer upgrades. The other's a little more complex. It's a permanent sales tax planned as one move in a complex strategy to fund parks and streets. To explain how these are supposed to work, Alex Smith spoke with Lynn Horsley, who covers City Hall for The Star. She started with the sales tax.
The increase is a half-cent sales tax increase, and it is meant to pay for improvements to the city's parks, or basically keeping the parks with a more stable source of funding. The Kansas City Parks Department has absorbed $9 million in cuts in the last 5 years, and they say it's made it increasingly difficult for them to keep the parks, playgrounds, community centers up to par. And so the sales tax money would be dedicated to the Parks Department, and it would provide about $3 million more for operations than they currently receive. The Parks Department currently gets other general fund money. That money would then be available to go for a new street fund. And the ballot language allows for dedicating 7.5% of the earnings tax collections to streets, which would be a minimum of $15 million and could be as much as $20 million for streets. So the city believes that by dedicating sales tax to the parks, it allows them to free up other tax money for the streets, and you get improvements to both parks and streets, which are things that citizens say are top priorities for them and also things that they feel the city has not been properly maintaining to date.
So I guess this is meant in part to replace a vehicle fee and some property taxes. Are those going to end no matter what, or does that depend on voters approving this tax?
The vehicle fee is set to expire in August no matter what. And the vehicle fee raises about $3.5 million, which has generally gone for community centers. The total community center budget is about $4.4 million. So this is a large chunk of the money that goes to community centers. That fee is slated to expire, and the city is not planning to renew that. The property taxes are modest parkway and trafficway taxes, and there's a boulevard tax that some people pay if they live along a boulevard. Those would halt, the city would stop collecting those property taxes, but only if voters approve the sales tax increase.
Mm-hmm. So would this sales tax shift more of the burden of the street and park maintenance to lower income people who might not have vehicles and property to tax and fee?
There is some concern. A sales tax is regressive. And of course, if you don't own property, but you buy food or goods, you are going to be paying the sales tax. Whereas if you own a car or several cars or a home or you live along a boulevard, you would pay this property tax. However, the sales tax is also paid by people who don't live in Kansas City, but who maybe shop in Kansas City and who probably use the streets and the parks. So it spreads the burden to people who live in the metro area but use Kansas City's parks and streets. I think about a third of the tax is paid by non-residents, whereas these property taxes and the vehicle fee are paid only by residents. So the city feels like in this way they're able to spread the tax burden a little bit farther with the sales tax.
Now, as I understand it, the city has offered to pay more for street maintenance if the tax passes. Is that right?
Kansas City has never had a dedicated street fund, and yet streets are constantly top priority for citizens in citizen satisfaction surveys. And most of those surveys show that citizens are not very happy right now with the condition of their streets. They think they're too bumpy and falling apart. So if the voters approve this sales tax and there's this new money for parks, the city says it can free up this earnings tax money and dedicate it to streets.
Mm-hmm. And that is, I guess, this $15 million pledge they were talking about.
$15 million. Now, engineers and experts in infrastructure maintenance say that Kansas City should be spending a minimum of $30 million on streets. We've never gotten close to that. Currently, this year, the city is budgeted $8 million, which is a paltry sum for the volume of streets we have. We have some of the largest number of lane miles per capita of any city in the country. $8 million is not enough to maintain all of Kansas City's streets. The idea would be that you would take this $15 million, which is a portion of the earnings tax, plus at least part of that $8 million that's currently budgeted, and in future years would allocate some of that money so that there might be as much as $20 million or $23 million for streets, which is a lot closer to the $30 million that we should be spending than just $8 million, which is the current street fund. With this sales tax, it would bump Kansas City's base sales tax rate up above 8%. And that would be close to what it is in Johnson County. It would be among the higher sales tax rates in the community. And there is a concern that if Kansas City's sales tax rate keeps going up and up, that really could be, you know, put Kansas City at a competitive disadvantage to some of the other communities.
Now, the second ballot measure will ask voters to allow the city to issue $500 million in bonds. What's that money for?
Well, Kansas City is under a consent decree with the federal government. There are new federal regulations about maintaining our sewers and dramatically reducing the amount of pollution, wastewater pollution, that's been going into Kansas City's rivers and streams. And this has been something that's been in the works for years, but now Kansas City has to do these improvements to the sewers. And if they don't maintain the schedule and keep to the schedule that's required by the federal government, there will be fines. And it is a very expensive program. Overall, it's supposed to cost $2.5 billion. This is a start on that project. And it would go for sewer improvements throughout the city to start alleviating that wastewater pollution. To pay for those bonds, Kansas Cityans will see their sewer rates go up by about 15% for a couple of years and then 13% until 2020. And these are big increases. People are already starting to really scream bloody murder about their water and sewer rates. However, if people vote no on this bond authorization, their rates will go up even faster. They will almost double in the next 2 or 3 years. And that's because the city has to make these investments, and they can either raise the money up front by raising rates very quickly, or they can do the bonding and raise the rates over time, over until about 2020.
Lynn Horsley, thank you so much for your time.
Sure, thank you.
If you missed any of these election stories today, or for ongoing election coverage, go to our website, kcur.org, and type in Election 2012.
Coming up, a conversation with recently retired KC Fire Chief Smokey Dyer. This is KC Currents.
This is KC Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith.
Out on the plains, drought is parching everything from corn to cattle. And when the prairie grass burns up, so does a business model that depends on it, ranching. Frank Morris reports.
It's hot and dry out in western Kansas in a good year.
South of Dodge City, the native grass is tough. So are the ranchers.
My name is Nathan Pike.
Pike is 78. He was born in the Dust Bowl, and this is the worst drought he's ever seen. Relentless, windy, hot days with no rain have torched his pastures.
You can see what we're up against. This old stuff is no good at all, and we're in a fire hazard.
Pike's cows won't eat this stuff, so he has to buy hay hauled in from greener pastures or corn, with fields of both withering from Indiana to Colorado. His feed prices have spiked. Pike can't make money feeding cattle this way, so he sold most of his herd to a slaughterhouse.
I've been in the business for 62 years. That's quite a little while. This is the least cattle I've owned in at least 52 years.
We heard similar stories last year in Texas and Oklahoma.
Dan Loy at Iowa State University says that now, with drought sparking a sell-off in Kansas and Nebraska,
the national cattle herd currently is the lowest it's been since 1950.
When there were half as many people. The effects of this drought will take years to play out. Desperation selling is suppressing beef prices for now. It's also butchering the production capability of this industry. Ranchers are sacrificing healthy cows that would otherwise keep having calves for years. Pike thinks this will lead to big corporations forcing ranchers like himself to work under contract, a situation where the corporations own the cows and tell the rancher how to raise them, rather than selling on the open market, as ranchers like himself always have.
What I think will happen is the corporates will come out here and they will want to finance the cows because they know it's going to be hard for everybody to get back in. They will come out and say, we'll finance your cows, but you're going to run a certain breed, you're going to handle them, you're going to feed them to our specs. In other words, we're going to be serfs on our own land. And I think this is a perfect storm for it to happen.
Dan Loy isn't so sure. He thinks ranching will recover, but that it will take time. The dead pastures of western Kansas could take years to fill in again. In the meantime, the supply of beef is bound to tighten, leaving customers to pay more, and a lot of ranchers wishing they still had cattle to sell. Frank Morris, Harvest Public Media.
This past week, Kansas City's Fire Chief Smokey Dyer retired after 12 years at the helm. The son of a firefighter, Smokey's career spans over 40 years, including a stint as Lee Summit's fire chief. He leaves behind a reputation for transforming the Kansas City Fire Department and for greatly improving relationships between the firefighters' union and city government. But budget woes at City Hall and an attractive early retirement package have prompted Smokey to exit. Susan sat down with him after his last day.
Why did you first want to become a firefighter?
Well, it's a long story, and it sounds a little hokey, especially looking back on it, but it was in a different day and a different time. My dad was the volunteer fire chief in Buckner, Missouri, one of the smaller communities in eastern Jackson County. And I assumed that he put the mayor up to it, but when I was 5 years old, the mayor called me, and it was after the first meeting of the volunteers when the volunteer fire department had reorganized due to a devastating fire that had occurred in Buckner. And the mayor, who was a gentleman then by the name of Arnold Ward, asked me if I would be willing to serve as the junior assistant fire chief. And I accepted, and then I started responding to fires with my father.
How old were you then?
5 years old. And I was even released from school to go on fires. And whenever the volunteer fire department would respond by the school, I was permitted to go out on the sidewalk. And the first engine that would go by would stop and pick me up and open up the door and throw me in. And then I continued to respond throughout all of my school days. And becoming a state certified firefighter at the age of 15 and then start fighting fires with firefighters on the inside of buildings at that age, and then started driving fire apparatus at the age of 16.
So yesterday was your last day. What was that like, and how do you feel about it?
It was different. I was relieved in many ways of all the pressures, and especially the fiscal situation the department currently finds itself in as part of city government, and as most urban cities throughout the country are facing. And as chief, you have the responsibility to bring together the resources that give our personnel and all of our missions the ability to do their job and serve their public and to ensure their safety. And when you're unable to do that adequately, then there's a tremendous amount of stress that comes with the job. So being able to leave and not having that stress anymore is a great relief, immediately having a lower in blood pressure and less muscle tension. But then on the other side of the coin, leaving the fire service after the only thing you've really known, and a lot of times people say in their adult life, in my case, it's my entire life, then walking out the door knowing that that's the last time that you're going to be back to fire headquarters in an official position, the last time you're going to put on a uniform, the people that have been so supportive and have worked with you as a team in fire headquarters here in Kansas City for a past dozen years. It's very emotional for me.
Now, you were talking about the economic situation here in the city. Is that part of why you thought this was a good time to retire? I know you were quoted as saying that, you know, you really weren't interested in being a leader in a time of retraction.
That is correct. Yes, that we have, over the past 12 years, been able, to my opinion, to build one of the best emergency service organizations of any urban city in America. And that includes our missions in fire protection, emergency medical service, rescue services, and hazardous materials emergency response. In my opinion, there just aren't going to be the fiscal resources in the future to be able to have the same type of organization that we have today. And so whether you call it right-sizing or re-engineering or whatever phrase that you might want to use to describe it, the fire department in Kansas City is going to be different in the future. And I think that we have built an outstanding department, and I did not want to go through the process of recreating a department that some may describe as leaner and meaner, but it takes a certain amount of resources to be able to respond at all times.
Critics have alleged that the merger of the fire department and MAST have led to slower response times. How have you responded to this criticism?
Well, to some circles of the elected officials, my response has not been effective. And then the first thing that I thought it was crucial for us to do is to report response times without any editing and without any filtering of the numbers. And when these response time standards were originally created in Kansas City 30 years ago, they were because there was a private contractor, and that private contractor was trying to make a profit and return those profits to the ownership of the ambulance operation. And so for a way for the city to ensure that the operator did not reduce the response resources down to an unacceptable level, response time standards were put in to say, how we're going to measure that you are keeping enough resources on the number of ambulances and personnel on duty. And then if you can meet the response times, you can cut it down right to what the response time level is and that's required in the ordinance. And then any gravy you can make above that is yours. And the more efficient you can become, you can even make a larger profit. But then the city said, but we understand that it would be difficult for you to make those response times when it's snowy. So we will have weather exceptions. And then it got down to the point over the 30 years, if it was raining, if there was a shower, all of those response times were taken out of the numbers. So what has really happened is that right now KCFD's published reports do not match up as well as the MAST reports because we're preparing unedited reports. It's the actual performance of every life-threatening call, every life-threatening dispatch that goes out. And for a long time, I was trying not to criticize the past system and criticize the way that it was done previously by MAST. And they weren't doing anything wrong. It's what the city permitted in this resource management. But then we tried to compare those two reports, primarily by the Kansas City Star and by two or three council members, and it's been a red herring. We have the best emergency medical system that this city has ever seen right now today, and we have one of the best ones in the United States. And right now we're showing that we have the third best cardiac arrest survival rate that exists anywhere in America in an urban environment. Well, if we were having bad response times, you cannot have those kinds of patient outcomes.
You're listening to Casey Currents. I'm talking with Smokey Dyer, outgoing Kansas City fire chief, who is retiring. You also led changes in opportunities and in the work climate for women, and this was a difficult and contentious issue for a time there. How did you successfully tackle this at that time?
Well, one, we immediately worked to improve the conditions in the stations and by the fire sales tax and putting a lot of money toward that mission. That was the first thing, I think, to show the women of the organization that we were committed to giving them a good place to work and a place that would have privacy. The second thing was, I think, of creating a culture where anything that would make a woman uncomfortable on the job was not going to be tolerated. And I made the decision at that point that every disciplinary case that would be heard by the fire department that would be serious in nature, where it could lead to a suspension or termination from the job, that I heard all of those cases myself, instead of delegating that. And so hopefully sending a signal to the women that if you have a problem, I'm going to be the one hearing your complaint and deciding what is the appropriate course of action to change the behaviors of our organization. And then I think then ensuring in this labor management partnership of working with the union to ensure that on all of our significant committees that the union would ensure that there would be women present. And then promoting women to the ranks of battalion chief and now having the first woman deputy chief that the department's ever had in its 145-year history to be part of the command staff.
Looking back, what were some of your more difficult days or any regrets that you have?
The regrets that I have are those things about trying to appear more flexible on these ambulance issues and not being, I guess, more amenable to public relations and spin. As I have gotten older, probably, and more experienced, then I've gotten more set in my ways and saying, if we're doing an outstanding job, then I'm not too amenable of listening to politicians to say, well, not in our opinion, we think you need to be doing it another way. We have an outstanding command staff and a set of chief officers that have given their entire life's work to this mission of emergency services. And to think that there can be somebody elected on a part-time basis that knows more about this job than they do is unbelievable to me that anybody would accept that. And so that's the way I thought about it. And many times I was very direct with the responses and not being as political as I could be. The one thing about it, it's a two-edged sword, though. The more direct I am at City Hall, the more I tell them the way it is, I think the greater respect it gives me in the fire stations throughout the city, the more than spin doctor I could have been. I think it would have eased tensions at City Hall, but then I would have had less respect from our workforce. Am I really the fire chief, or am I just a politician wearing a fire department uniform? The worst days were our line of duty death days, and that is what is the most stressful for the organization, and I think it's the greatest stressors of any fire chief. And then the most difficult days next to that are our days of severe injuries to our personnel, where it wasn't death, but being there and seeing our personnel who are going to live the rest of their lives with pain and discomfort every day of their life of injuries that they sustained while serving our community. Those were the worst days that I have encountered.
So what's your proudest accomplishment?
My proudest accomplishment in Kansas City is creating the labor management partnership and putting together a department that is based on consensus decision making. I think that what's going on in the country, fighting labor like it is some kind of criminal element, is really a disservice to our working men and women throughout the country. I think that where we ought to be concentrating on is finding methods and ways for labor and management to work together and to find win-win solutions that may sound like, you know, some spin term. But I think that we have proven in our department that that type of relationship really can work. And if we're just always fighting and saying we're going to take away your pensions, we're going to take away your pay, we're going to increase your work hours without discussing it with you, we're going to build up a bitter labor workforce. And in government, that's not going to serve the community well.
Well, Smokey Dyer, it's been a pleasure having you on Casey Currents, and best wishes in your retirement.
And thank you very much for having me today and being able, where I was able to voice my true opinions that my first day of retirement as a Kansas City citizen as opposed to a public servant.
Smokey Dyer, retiring fire chief for the Kansas City Fire Department. Deputy Chief Paul Berardi, a 26-year veteran of the KCFD, will step in as interim fire chief.
If you can't listen to all of Casey Currents today, catch what you missed online in our audio archives, and we've got a podcast. Find us on iTunes.
Coming up, fixing a farm that's been in the family for generations. This is Casey Currents.
This is Casey Currents. I'm Alex Smith.
And I'm Susan Wilson.
In area news this week, Missouri malpractice settlement limits were declared unconstitutional. Fewer than 500 people determined the fate of a Kansas City streetcar system, and a former priest facing child pornography charges admitted his guilt. KCUR's Steve Bell recaps those and other top stories of the week on KCUR's Weekend News Review.
Our recommendation will be a virtual life sentence to ensure that there's no opportunity for him to harm another child,
said Acting U.S. Attorney David Ketchmark after former priest Sean Rattigan pleaded guilty to 5 federal charges of felony child sexual abuse. And Ketchmark had no doubt he could get that sentence.
When a defendant who wears a religious collar, who has the trust of a community, engages in conduct of this nature, his crimes are more devastating and more reprehensible.
Rattigan admitted to taking pornographic pictures of 5 little girls, ages 2 through 9. The Catholic Diocese and Bishop Robert Finn face misdemeanor charges for shielding Rattigan from arrest and investigation. Plans for a streetcar from the River Market to Crown Center rolled ahead After voters along the route approved creating a special taxing district to help pay for it, immediately Councilman Russ Johnson announced plans for phase two of the transit project.
They will include alignments along Independence Avenue, 12th Street, 18th Street, Pershing to the Plaza, Southwest Boulevard. And North Kansas City, we are seeking a partnership with them to cross the river and enter into North Kansas City.
That's to be voted on yet. Voting on the district for phase one was restricted to residents of the district, and only 459 cast acceptable ballots. 69% of them voted for the streetcars. The Missouri Supreme Court struck down a signature piece of legislation of the Matt Blunt administration, a law that capped non-economic damages in medical malpractice cases at $350,000. Tom Holloway with the Missouri Medical Association said,
"This is going to set off a powder keg of uncertainty in the professional liability insurance market."
But plaintiff's lawyers said though the legislature can't constitutionally limit what a jury can do, judges can respond to excessive awards, and that malpractice cases have been steadily declining over the last decade, even before the state passed the caps. The High Court also upheld the state auditor's authority to prepare fiscal notes and summaries for citizen-initiated ballot questions. Current auditor Tom Schweik said the decision ensures a continued flow of necessary information for informed voting.
Had it been ruled unconstitutional, there wouldn't have been that guidance for the voters. It really would have just been subject to advertising campaigns by well-funded special interest groups.
The court also ruled that the auditor and secretary of state had provided fair and sufficient ballot information for measures that would raise the state's cigarette tax and minimum wage and limit interest charged on payday loans. The signature count is not yet completed on those initiatives. Heading into primary election week, Kansas Secretary of State Chris Kobach predicted the lowest turnout of the decade in Kansas, 18%. That's despite larger-than-ever spending in legislature races as conservatives and moderates battle for control of the Kansas Senate.
There aren't any hotly contested congressional races on the primary ballot, and there are no statewide races on the primary ballot.
Secretary of State Robin Carnahan predicted that about 25% of registered voters will show up in the Show Me State, where Republican races for the Senate and the governor's chair are hotly competitive. This is KCUR.
A couple of weeks ago, Harvest Public Media started a new series called My Farm Roots. These are American stories and memories of rural life. Harvest Public Media's Peggy Lowe has this latest installment.
Our youngest Farm Roots contributor is a member of the oldest agricultural organization in the country. I met 25-year-old Nolan Strotter at a meeting of the National Grange, a group formed after the Civil War to champion farmers' rights. The Grange has lost a little luster since its early days, kind of like the old farmhouse Strotter's now fixing up. He hopes to put his mark on both.
I'm Nolan Strotter from Burlington, Kansas, and I live on a fifth-generation family farm. I've lived there for 10 years, went to college, and moved back, and now I'm the primary resident. I have a day job. I'm a mechanical engineer at Wolf Creek Nuclear Power Plant and work there 40 hours a week and then come home and basically try to... The farm has been overgrowing for the last 5 years whenever I was gone at college, so my project is to fix it back up and make the house nicer and improve the property back to where it was 15 years ago whenever we first got out there. So that's mostly what I do with my time. I lived there since third grade, and my mom grew up there. Her name and all of her brothers and sisters' names are written in the concrete, and my grandparents lived there and their parents and back one more time, I believe. Most of the barns and concrete pads, they have names in it where you can see who actually did the pouring of the concrete and created the fence and the feedlots. And whenever I was in high school, I didn't have free will to do whatever I wanted to, I guess, since I had my parents and my brothers and sisters there too. I was kind of restricted, and I always envisioned fixing up the feedlot and changing the farm to where I can put my name on something and putting my mark on it. And I always kind of wanted to do that. So now that I'm out there, I've been trying to make it unique to me, because everybody that's lived out there, they've done something different, and I'm trying to do the same. As far as I know, everybody that's lived at that house is part of my family's been in the Grange, and they've done things traditional, just like the Grange. It's the Grange is kind of like a second family reunion that we have every year. Get together and you see people you haven't seen in a while, and it's a comfortable place.
To hear more My Farm Roots stories or to share your own, visit harvestpublicmedia.org/myfarmroots. Thanks for tuning in to Casey Currents. This show will be archived along with all of our past shows on the Casey Currents page at kcur.org.
You can also hear individual stories there or sign up for our podcast. Or you can find us on iTunes. Contact us at kccurrents@kcur.org or on Twitter at kccurrents. Casey Currents is produced by Alex Smith and Suzanne Hogan. Our senior producer is Sylvia Maria Gross. Our intern is Zach Lewandowski, and our theme music is by Approach. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith.